You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 6th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Could Germany yet be embarrassed into supplying Taurus missiles to Ukraine and the eternal folly of politicians affecting normality? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Daniela Peled and John Everard, will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll speak with the director, Thea Sharrock, about her new film, Wicked Little Letters. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Daniela Peled, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and by the former British diplomat, John Everard. Hello to you both.
Hello, hello.
John, as the most conspicuously overdressed guest at this table, you can go first. To what great distinguished event have you just come from, or are you going to?
I have just scored a lifetime first. I have been to my neighbour's dog's birthday party, a merry event full of...
Clearly with a remarkable... remarkably strict dress code.
Actually, I was rather more relaxed on this on that occasion. Oh. This is for something non-canine related, I'm afraid. It was a great pity, because I think dogs' birthday parties, I discovered, are rather fun. You get a quadrupeds menu and a bipeds menu. The bipeds menu is fairly predictable. Quadrupeds menu includes things like, you know, beef, various kind of pâtés, and you also get a dog's birthday cake, which turns out is largely bread, because they couldn't think of anything to put inside it, with lots of dog biscuits on. So the dog happily licked all the biscuits off, wagged its tail, and we sang happy birthday. So
and now you're here participating in a dog's breakfast.
I hope not.
it seems germane that we should say happy birthday to the dog in question. Can you tell us its name, what variety of hound it is and how old it is?
Its name is Teddy. He was 5 years old on Saturday, and he is a Bijou Pomeranian mix, which is small and quite pretty looking. A very fine dog.
Happy birthday, Teddy.
Happy birthday, Teddy, from
all of us. I'm more of a cat person myself. Just thought I should mention.
Okay, well, we're off to a controversial start. Daniela, can you compete with that? Have you been to anything akin to a dog's birthday party or indeed a dog's breakfast recently?
I can't really, except the only thing that's possibly approaching that is I went to say goodbye to a comically overstuffed walrus at the weekend.
Okay.
Residents of South London might be familiar with the comically overstuffed walrus at the Horniman Museum. In Forest Hill.
Is it comically overstuffed deliberately, or is this hapless taxidermy?
The hapless taxidermy, which is always the best kind of taxidermy.
I think I saw hapless taxidermy opening for 70 Gwen Party at the Camden Falcon in about 1992, now that I think of it.
Yeah, so apparently it's been on display for a good 100 years, and the gallery's closing down, so all these rather moth-eaten Victorian dead things, which also includes a whole gallery of dog's heads, sorry to say. Is going to be refurbished. So maybe when they return, the walrus will be less comically overstuffed.
South London is kind of a haven for mental Victorian stuff, though. They have that huge park full of, like, weird dinosaur sculptures in Crystal Palace.
Yes,
which
indeed.
Is amazing.
Yeah.
And I do enjoin listeners visiting London to visit that, because it barely makes the top 500 attractions in this great city, but it's pretty wild. I fear we may be deviating from the point somewhat. So we will pivot to the United States, which yesterday staged what may have been in all of its electoral history the Super Tuesday least worthy of that billing. President Joe Biden cleaned up the Democratic primaries, except in American Samoa, which shouldn't derail his campaign untowardly. Donald Trump, the Republican, to the extent that Trump's last remaining challenger, former South Carolina governor and UN ambassador Nikki Haley, threw the towel in. Barring an act of God, or perhaps in Trump's case, an act of judge and jury, this November will see its first presidential election rematch since 1956, when, fact fans, Dwight Eisenhower defeated Adlai Stevenson for the second time. John, how excited are you for this prospect now that it is all but confirmed that once again Americans will have to choose between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, just both 4 years older than they were last time?
I share the general despair that that we've got a rerun of this kind between two very old men. But I was actually rather more excited by the Super Tuesday outcome than I thought I would be. I was intrigued by how badly Trump did in so many states. OK, he won the states. Mm-hmm. But Nikki Haley was taking very big bites out of his vote. It turns out that her benchmark, that the point at which she would have stayed in the campaign, was to get overall about 40%. She didn't make that, but she came very close. She was getting 25-30% in a lot of states, and crucially, in a lot of swing states. Now, the exit polling shows pretty clearly that the great majority of the people who voted for Nikki Haley, splendid woman though she is, were actually voting not for her, but against Donald Trump. The implication being that come election day, these people are very likely to stay at home. With that dent in your voting base, Donald Trump is in real trouble.
Well, there's another cohort, Daniela, which may be staying at home as well, which will be troubling Joe Biden. These are Democratic voters who are displeased with his response to the war in the Middle East. And as we saw last week in Michigan, we've had big uncommitted organised protest votes campaigns, which is to say, that sentence was all the wrong way around, wasn't it? We organised campaign of people voting uncommitted, 20% in Minnesota, 12% in North Carolina. Should Biden be worried about that? North Carolina in particular is a genuine swing state, or will he be reassuring himself that, what are we up to? March, 8 months is a long time in politics.
Well, I mean, I think Biden should be slightly concerned about this pretty disastrous foreign policy in many respects, especially over Israel and Gaza. But although, look, this is a discussion we're also having here in the United Kingdom as well. We've got a general election coming up at some point this year. Many activists and people on the left and opponents of the policy towards the Palestinians are saying, right, OK, so the government is going to be punished for this. Labour is going to be punished for it because for not supporting a ceasefire immediately, et cetera, et cetera. And I think these issues have an impact. I mean, this is a very serious and a sort of watershed moment. This is a defining moment for many people politically, especially a younger generation. But history shows us that people are not single issue voters. And also, it would be an extraordinary act of self-harm if people who supported the Palestinians were to effectively usher in a Trump presidency. I mean, I think we've seen already his deal of the century, which is Israel making deals with a variety of Gulf states, and Jerusalem becoming, you know, the US embassy being moved to Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights being annexed, and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, that would be the height of performative kind of idiocy, really.
Well, the trouble is that performative idiocy has arguably been the dominating tenor of the politics of a lot of the Western world in recent years. John, were you surprised / heartened as well, though, by the number of Republican voters? And it was 40% in Virginia, 32% in North Carolina. And these are big numbers, who said that they would regard a conviction of Donald Trump as disqualifying as far as being president goes.
Yes, I was heartened. Who knows whether we'll get a conviction? But if 40% say that a conviction would be a disqualification, there'll be a significant, although smaller, percentage who will feel that something short of conviction, I mean, clear legal jeopardy deepening, also effectively disqualifies him, and they aren't going to go out and vote for him.
Well, I mean, but the obvious response to that, and I know it's been said about Trump many, many times, that almost any other politician tarnished by even a fraction of the scandal surrounding him would have been underwater long ago.
The point here is that this is not normal politics, that Trump is not running a political party, he is running a cult. And he has a base of supporters who will believe virtually anything he says. Now, normal rules apply to cults. This has been closely studied, and we know how these things play out. You carry these people forward indefinitely until, in the famous words of the Reverend Moon, the mirror cracks. You get a moment where you you say the wrong thing in the wrong place, or you show weakness, and all of a sudden your support doesn't just drop, it collapses. And I suspect that is one of the big unknowns in this electoral campaign. If Trump can keep going as he is, he's a credible candidate. If, however, he does something wrong, if a court passes a judgment that deeply upsets sufficient numbers of his voters and it goes viral, then all of a sudden he's a nobody and Biden walks it.
Well, the disheartening aspect of that, though, John, is that so far at least his base have been entirely, about a court passing a judgment against him on a matter of sexual assault.
And they will be until they're not.
Daniela, just finally before we move on to other things, because we may mention the US presidential campaign once or twice more in the next 8 months or so, do you actually anticipate, now that it is pretty much certain that it will be Trump v. Biden round two, do you anticipate it being really any different to last time out?
I anticipate it being fraught because it seems an almost existential question right now. But also I anticipate it being extremely lackluster. And with so many people, you know, people might vote against, but I can't imagine there are many Democrat voters who are going, woo, yeah, I'm going to vote for Biden another 4 years. I mean, really.
Another 4 years, fingers crossed.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And this kind of apathy and sort of general, like, you know, what does this present a younger generation with? What kind of a choice is this? What kind of enthusiasm is this? That's what I'm anticipating in bucket loads of that for the election.
Excellent. Well, moving along to the source of President Biden's difficulties with a cohort of his own base, negotiations aimed at brokering a ceasefire in Gaza appear to have faltered, despite hopes that the looming onset of Ramadan may have focused all concerned. The talks in Cairo had conspicuously lacked one key protagonist, Israel, which declined to send a delegation to the latest round of talks, leaving Hamas to complain to mediators from Egypt, the US and Qatar, all of whom have vowed to continue discussions regardless. President Biden, meanwhile, has reiterated his enthusiasm for a ceasefire suggested that the ball is largely in Hamas's court. Daniela, first of all, I know that this has been an Israeli talking point pretty much since October 8th, but is that entirely wrong? At any point, Hamas have had the option of coming out with their hands up and giving all the hostages back.
That would be an important first step. But you know, Israel has also made it quite clear that the objective is to dismantle them or defang them and make sure that something like this won't be able to happen again. So for all that, I mean, if they sent a few busloads over with hostages, I'm not sure that would just bring this to an immediate conclusion.
And does it strike you, John, that Israel is nevertheless holding conspicuously off on the full-scale assault on Rafah? Is it almost like Israel is trying, or at least is willing, to be talked out of this?
I think Israel might be talked out of this if hostages are released. Daniel is quite right. Netanyahu would much prefer just to destroy Hamas. But if the hostages are released, I think the political support for that position would evaporate and Netanyahu would be forced to do a deal. Are they holding off? No, I don't think so. I think they're ready to pounce if the deal isn't struck. One key point that I think we need to focus on here is that Israel has agreed to the deal and has therefore withdrawn its delegation. That is what you do in these negotiations. If you're offered a package by the mediators and you say, yes, that's fine, we'll do that, you get out of the way, because if you stay in the room, the other side will try to push you back further from that package. So you disappear and leave Hamas, in this case, holding the baby, point one. Point two, it is becoming painfully obvious that Hamas is actually incapable of producing something as straightforward as a list of hostages. Now, why this is, we don't know. It may be because they simply don't have sufficiently good communication within Hamas. It may be because the hostages are being held by other groups, or it may be some other reason. But you have to ask yourself, if Hamas cannot deliver something that simple, what are the chances of Hamas being able, let alone willing, to actually implement the terms of any deal?
Daniela, there is also a conventional wisdom doing the rounds in some quarters that persisting with any sort of offensive in Gaza during Ramadan, which begins on the 10th, would be somehow dangerous or provocative. Is that overthinking it a bit? Is that likely to upset anybody any more than what is already happening already has?
Well, I mean, we get to the point where you think, oh, things can't be any worse. But yes, I think things can be worse. But it hasn't stopped previous rounds of fighting at all. But I think it does present Israel with a watershed moment. And also the pressure from its allies, even from Biden, is growing, not only externally, but also internally. the demands of most Israelis is to bring hostages back. It isn't to carry on fighting in Gaza. And although this is the Ramadan is due to start, I think, on Sunday. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't leave us a lot of time. But, you know, the Israelis can also walk away from the negotiations because they're sending a message to the domestic constituency saying we're willing to go this far and no further. So it doesn't do them any harm. But the issue is as well, you know, in terms of domestic politics, Netanyahu, it's not in his interests for this to be done and dusted, although he will be delighted if he's still prime minister by the time that, in the event of a Trump presidency, the anger against him and his government and the way the security lapses and the way this has been dealt with is so immense that as soon as there is a proper pause in the fighting, the chickens are going to come home to roost, which is not to say that he's, you know, prolonging like active conflict just for that. But, you know, that's a consideration.
Just a final thought on this one, John. There have been more airdrops of aid over Gaza. This is a joint United States-Jordanian operation, one assumes, with Israeli permission. And it's probably better than nothing, although, as anybody who has worked in aid will know, this is about the worst way you can possibly deliver aid to people. It's by definition imprecise, and for obvious reasons, it tends to favour the people who need it the least. This is a fairly Darwinian undertaking. The strong and the swift will get what's in the parcels. But is it clear to you why Israel is being so, well, beyond difficult, really, on this point? Wouldn't enabling the supply of decent amounts of aid to people in Gaza be, even aside from being what would seem like the right and compassionate thing to do, just a fairly easy PR win?
Yes, that you're quite right. This is something of a mystery. Why is Israel being so difficult about this? And why, in particular, we had a classic example just hours ago, did the Israeli checkpoint prevent that aid convoy of, I think, 14 trucks from reaching North Gaza, where the fighting perhaps hasn't quite stopped. It certainly is no longer the focus of conflict. They could have done that without in any way compromising their strategic position. There's a lot in the Israeli attitude here that I think needs explanation.
I mean, I think one potential cause for this, or at least a contributing cause, is that there is wide support, awful as it is to say, amongst the Israeli public for not letting humanitarian aid into Gaza. I mean, polling shows that a clear majority oppose it. And maybe not necessarily because they want the people in Gaza to suffer, but they see it as their key way of getting the hostages back. And even so, right-wing extremists, and dominated by right-wing extremists, some secular as well, have been actually gathering at the borders to try and stop trucks of aid coming in. They're having sort of festivals and parties and hanging out candy floss to children. I mean, this is a really ugly phenomenon that we've seen within Israel. And there really isn't any domestic pressure to allow aid. And also, it's also become just part of the conflict. Israelis believe that if you let aid into Gaza, then Hamas will steal it and sell it and use concrete to build tunnels. I mean, that's the mindset. And right now, in the middle of conflict, they're really not willing to temper that attitude at all.
Well, to the ongoing fallout from this week's leak of a conversation among Luftwaffe brass, one of the topics of the chat among the senior German Air Force officers was Germany's long-range missile system Taurus, which Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz has been unkeen to supply to Ukraine, to the obvious vexation of Ukraine and the apparent irritation of his own military. The UK has now publicly joined the chorus asking for the Taurus to be delivered to Ukraine. Its range of nearly 500 kilometres is around twice that of the Storm Shadow system already dispatched by the UK. John, just thinking back to your time in the diplomatic, would you be able to give a sense of right now how incredibly irritated absolutely everybody is with Germany over the fact of this leak?
Yes, but not in polite language. I suspect
couch it in diplomatic euphemism.
It would be something like, old chap, I'd much rather you hadn't done that. The Germans have got a sad track record of blunders of this kind, and the explanation as to how this leak happened, that somebody dialed in on an open hotel Wi-Fi from Singapore, I mean, why didn't you just send the transcript to the Moscow straight away, you know, save them the trouble, is a head-and-hands job. Some of the things that have been said to the Germans have been perhaps a little unfair, but they have big red faces, and rightly so. It was a stupid blunder. Fortunately, it turns out that the officers concerned weren't actually saying anything too damaging. I mean, we knew that the Brits have people on the ground in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. That was announced, a week ago. We know a lot about Torres's capabilities, which they were discussing. They didn't actually put anything that wasn't in the public domain out there. And we know that Torres can be used, for example, to destroy a bridge in the east, as they enigmatically said, being very careful.
Whatever could they mean?
Whatever could they mean? I'm sure they had the Kremlin guessing for hours on that one. But otherwise, the big thing that it shows is that the Luftwaffe wants to supply Taurus. And why did Moscow therefore leak this recording? I mean, the obvious answer is because they leaked it on the day of Navalny's funeral. They were trying to distract attention. Okay. If this was the best one they had to distract attention, they must be getting a bit desperate of putting it out there, you know, using your own resources to show the world that the Luftwaffe wants to send Taurus to Ukraine, you know, against the wishes of the Chancellor, and that if supplied, it could play merry hell with a lot of the Russian positions. Perhaps wasn't the best selected video.
No, it may just have given people ideas. Daniela, as is often the case, I think, as well, this with leaked conversations of this sort, it's kind of reassuring, really, in that it didn't tell us much that we either didn't know or couldn't have guessed. But it does demonstrate that there is a rift between Olaf Scholz and his military, and that's also fine. There's kind of supposed to be a rift between civilian governments and the military, and Lord knows there usually is over something. But do we yet understand what Chancellor Scholz's reservations about sending Taurus to Ukraine are? Is this just the latest in that series of squeamishnesses we have seen from Germany about sending various weapons to Ukraine? There was a whole thing about 18 months ago about sending Leopard tanks, for example.
I mean, to be fair, I mean, the Germans are pretty supportive. You know, within Europe, they supply the most amount of
this is true
military aid to Ukraine. So they are on side. But I think this squeamishness is really about not wanting to be dragged in as a country, you know, and it's not just the Germans that have been worried about this. It's supplying the Ukrainians weapons with which they could reach really deep into Russian territory could mark an escalation, which I think countries are nervous about. The way things are going right now for Ukraine, I think that would be quite a temptation, right? To if you were supplied with those sorts of weapons, to really make use of them. I mean, the aforementioned bridge.
Yes, this mysterious bridge in the east.
Whatever
could they mean. It does make you wonder why we needed the Enigma machine, if this is this, if this is the German code level of German code writing.
Indeed, but you know, if you have the capability to destroy that, I don't think it would bring the entire war crashing to a halt. But wow, that's exactly what the Ukrainians want.
I think this is being driven not so much by squeamishnesses. I too struggle with the plural of that word.
I'm not sure there is one.
No, maybe not. But by Scholz's own cynical calculations about his sinking political position. Remember, the man is in deep political trouble. He knows that the polls show clearly a strong majority in Germany against deeper involvement in Ukraine. And he is trying to position himself as the peace chancellor, the one who held Germany back from the brink against all these baying wolves out there in the Luftwaffe, it turns out, and including, a miracle of miracles, his own foreign minister from the Greens, who have morphed from being a peace-loving, carrot-hugging party to being most enthusiastic supporters of arming Ukraine anywhere in the Bundestag.
Just finally on this, though, Daniela, it's not just where Germany's concerned, though. It's never just about the present. It's about their history as well. And I have had this conversation now with several current and former German diplomats and politicians who have all said quite starkly, especially just chatting off the record, yes, it's exactly that. I remember talking to one about the Leopard tanks who just said, you have to understand that the spectacle of German tanks, panzers, if you will, being loaded onto trains and sent east to fight the Russians, it makes a lot of Germans actually quite anxious.
Yeah, it doesn't play well, does it? Even now, talking about the Luftwaffe does remind me of a sort of Sunday afternoon, like Second World War movie. But we are reaching a pivotal moment. I mean, the war in Ukraine was supposed to be a stalemate, and I think now is edging towards not quite a stalemate. It's getting worse than that. So, you can say doing nothing is really a decision, but also Germany is not doing nothing. I mean, Germany is also recommitting recommitting to send weapons, bullets, things that Ukraine needs. But I think that sending tanks and sending large pieces of weaponry may be a step too far.
Well, here in the UK, meanwhile, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been making one of his intermittent attempts to seem like a relatively normal human being, even adjusting for the degree of difficulty involved in seeming normal when you're giving an interview on camera about how very normal you are. It is possibly not a classic of the genre.
I'm not a morning person.
No, that's fair. Sure, but you also just don't like making the bed. I mean, it bugs me, so I actually sometimes come up back into the flat from the office after we've all left to make the bed.
Yes.
I'll be irritated
skills.
If it's not
one of
his
special skills. My thing is, let's just sort of be done with, move on, but Rishi likes to have it done.
Nice and tidy.
When we were studying, I used to actually eat in my bed.
Oh.
And Rishi would come to my where I lived. Sometimes there would be plates in my bed.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
I'm not the most organised person, compared to Rishi.
Oh, that's me.
Definitely Rishi, but I am A for enthusiasm, so I see something...
Yeah, but then it requires redoing after you've been very enthusiastic.
But I still load it, and then Rishi comes and rearranges it.
It creates more work.
Rearranges
okay.
it, yes. It's
and
a team
then,
effort.
And then more goes in as a result.
Team effort.
John, Daniela, wake up, both of you. That was Rishi Sunak and his wife, Akshata Murthy, shortly before returning to shoveling banknotes into their solid gold fireplace with diamond-studded platinum shovels. Daniela, what do we think was going on there with the extremely porn soundtrack?
I'm glad I wasn't the only one that noticed that, but I think that might be hopefully that was the Grazia addition to it, not the number 10 suggestion.
One would hope so. John, do you see that putting much of a dent in Labour's 20-point poll lead?
Teehee. No, not exactly. I thought it was a fascinating example of the genre. Firstly, you could see in the video that Rishi Sunak really, really didn't want to be there.
Well, the only relatable aspect of it, frankly.
Yes, that's right, yes. That and an obsession with the dishwasher. Also, revealing right at the end that his favourite relaxation when he comes home after a hard day's work running the country is to watch the same episode of Friends over and over again. I mean, did he really have to go and say that?
Did he say which episode?
No, he didn't.
That
of
course
well.
Made a huge difference.
I bet it's a Ross episode.
Yes, but we'll never find out. I'm so old that I remember the 1969 We're At Home and We're Normal take on the royal family, the one where then Prince Charles playing his cello breaks a string and twangs it into Prince Edward's face, if you've ever seen it, which was equally cringe-making of its kind. But the great thing about being the royal family is you can then ban it, which is exactly what the Queen did. It ran until 1977, I think. And then thereafter, strangely, no more releases were allowed until it finally leaked onto YouTube a couple of years ago.
So, Daniel, I have never, ever had the least idea why politicians do this, why they pretend to watch the same TV programmes as everybody else or listen to the same music.
No one watches Friends anymore.
But my point, I believe, stands. I may be a niche voter in that it would matter to me not in the slightest if the Prime Minister or a given politician was anywhere on the spectrum from somewhat weird to absolutely barking mad, as long as, you know, potholes were being filled in, bins were being collected, and the place was, by and large, being governed competently. Why do politicians do this, especially when there's no chance they're going to pull it off on the grounds that they are zillionaires?
I think it's become one of these just media institutions. Like, if something's happening in a hospital, the journalist has to stand in front of the hospital doing talky hands, even though, you know, we expect it, the public expects it. And I think there is something to be said for trying to humanise your political leadership, although 9 times out of 10 it spectacularly backfires. The ways that it's been done not too badly is the Mumsnet interview that, that prospective prime ministers always do, where they're asked what is their favourite biscuit, and obviously their political advisors spend weeks agonising, should it be a Bourbon, should it be a Demi Dodger? Oh no, definitely not a Jammy Dodger. But you know, that allows a little bit of humanity to creep in. The funny thing about this this video, which I confess, in the interests of, you know, proper scrutiny, I did watch at least half of it. It was excruciating, but it also, in a way, rang quite true. I mean, these are the kind of tedious conversations you have with people that you've been married to for a long time. Even though, you know, since they are gazillionaires, I doubt anybody does any dishes in their house. But, you know, watching this, I cannot believe that their political advisor said, what you should say is, when I come home and I'm all stressed, I watch the same episode of Friends over and over again. That kind of rang true, actually. But I mean, it rang true, but it didn't reflect well on him. So it's a lose. It's a lose-lose anyway.
John, you mentioned there the famous debacle of the British royal family attempting to seem normal. But have there been any politicians you can recall, either in this country or anywhere else, who have actually been good at this kind of thing? Like when they have wanted to come across as a broadly normal, approachable, relatable human being, they have actually come across as that rather than as somebody trying to seem like one.
You know, I think the last politician who actually succeeded in this was F.D. Roosevelt in the 1930s, the famous fireside chats. Now, it turned out that by fireside, he didn't mean that he was going to be sitting by his fireside, but he assumed that you were sitting by yours as you listened to the radio. But it was actually done in his office rather than in, you know, the Oval Office. So it actually looked more or less domestic. And he sat there and chatted to the American people. And that worked. I mean, these are still radio classics. But every attempt since then has come unstuck, I think, because of the way that people's interaction with their politicians has changed. You may remember, going back again now, Neil Kinnock's attempt to invite the cameras into his home, which has been buried very, very deep by the Labour Party. If you can dig it out, it is almost as excruciating as Rishi and Rishi at home. But it did show that he too struggled with dishwashers.
Just a final thought then, Daniela, I'm trying to be a little bit sympathetic here. Do we also have to allow for the possibility that if the cameras came into any of our homes and filmed us trying to talk about how very normal we were and the normal things we do on a given day, we too would also sound kind of mad?
I disagree. I think it would. I would let the cameras in, and they would have a charming and exciting insight into my wonderful. Oh yeah, maybe not. Maybe not.
You forget, Daniela. I've been to your flat. Daniela Pellard and John Everard, thank you both for joining us. Finally, today, director Thea Sharrock's new film, Wicked Little Letters, is based on a bizarre true story from 1920s England. Set in a small village in the southeast, it follows the pious spinster Edith Swan, played by Olivia Colman, who begins receiving obscene anonymous letters and is quick to blame her problematic neighbour Rose. The film and culture critic Ashanti Omkar caught up with the director, as well as stars Anjana Vasan, cast as the town's lone female police officer, and Timothy Spall, who plays Edith's overbearing father.
The mystery of the obscene little Hampton letters is causing widespread distress across the nation.
Edith Swan takes it up the... and she loves it more than Christmas Day.
Only words matter.
She sucks 10 a week, minimum.
Holy heavens.
In the end, I think it's just jealousy.
Rose Gooding.
What you've given us is such a rich film that captures today's world, but set in a period setting. Now, yeah. I would love to hear about the process behind this and how you worked with the writing team to create what you've created. It's magical.
Well, I was very lucky on this because Johnny Sweet, who wrote the script, stayed with me throughout the whole process. And that isn't always given on film. Writers aren't always available. But Johnny absolutely made it possible. So it meant that any small or big changes or any kind of script changes, character details, throughout the whole process, he and I did very much together. Johnny stumbled upon the story of the letters, was so intrigued that this could possibly be true. It was the letters themselves that he got absolutely hooked into, and then started to read about the characters behind them, and then started to create a world in which this story could exist.
This is a story that I'm watching in 2024 and saying, this is exactly what I see online all the time. The trolling is happening. And you brought that to life with a different type of trolling. She's using calligraphy to write it. When you were adapting this from the little evidence you had probably and turned it into a full film, how much did you draw off the X and the Twitter and the Instagram?
To be honest, I think it's innately there. I think it's just a different way of expressing yourself. The major difference that we have now got so used to is the notion of privacy is much harder to come by nowadays. So if you want to say something publicly, anybody can now. Anybody has a voice. That's very, very different to 100 years ago. 100 years ago, it was the opposite. Here is a woman sort of screaming out almost. It's like she almost has a message, doesn't she? She needs to find her own voice and her own language. And she does it the only way she possibly can, which is to write one letter to one person and then to go from there. That's a much smaller, very private world, which we almost don't have anymore. So even if I was to write you a letter right now, just me to you, it's the easiest thing in the world for you to take a photo of it and troll it out there. And suddenly something very private has become very public. The world, if you like, has changed enormously in many ways. One of the things that I find most interesting about the conversations that are coming out of this film is how much have we as human beings changed in that time? And in some ways, we've changed enormously, and in others, hardly at all.
Very rarely do we see an Asian woman playing a character like that. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the first woman police woman, if I can call her
women
that.
Women police officer in Sussex, the first one.
Mm. My gosh. Yeah. I mean, when they presented you with this character, how did you feel? Did you jump at it and say, yes, I want to do this? Or did you think twice?
No, I didn't think twice because of a few reasons. One, that the script was genuinely funny. Before all the stuff about whether the politics sits right and all of that, I felt that it was genuinely funny and it worked. And all the characters, including Gladys, felt like they just jumped out of the page. So I knew this was going to be like an incredible ensemble. Then I find out the ensemble is actually incredible because it has people like Timothy Spall in it and Olivia Colman and Jesse and Lolly.
And Jana.
So I had to say yes, you know. And I think I know that she's based on a real person from history, but I think it was important for Thea to feel like this was a movie that was set in the 1920s, but it was also felt like a story for now. And I guess inclusion is part of trying to tell a story that feels like both present day and in the past. And there's like an element of irreverence about telling the history that way, which I loved. And I just wanted to make her feel like a real person. And I think anyone, doesn't matter what color of your skin, we've all been in a position where we've been underestimated, spoken over, you know, ignored. And I think that's what makes her relatable. And I think her journey of finally listening to her own instinct and her own intellect and solving the case through her own sort of temerity is what makes her interesting.
Timothy, in your case, you had to draw out a lot of issues of the time into your character, of how your, you know, your character looks at women, etc. Did you battle with it while trying to essay those roles? Or those scenes, I should say?
No, I've played some pretty ghastly people, as well as some saintly people. To me, you've got what they present, how they are, and most people don't really even themselves know why they are the way they are. We don't analyse ourselves that much. We're not in that position to do it. But it's important for me to this character because he reminded me, I mean, I'm old enough to have encountered quite a lot of old Edwardian men. I'm from the generation where in my family there were people who were talked about who were this controlling, this unpleasant, which means to me that he's indicative of a type of man that had gone through all sorts of terrible surprises and shocks in their own lives. This man had no idea that a war was going to come along and kill two of his sons. This man had no idea he was going to have 14 children. And then it was incumbent on him to be the leader of this group of people. All of that distraction, the responsibility for providing for these people. Now, this is not excusing his behaviour and his actions and his controllingness, but you can see why a lot of these men who didn't have any self-awareness found themselves in such a way. And the only way they could control their own selves and not fall apart as human beings was to be hard. And actually, they become representative of the sum total of their frustrations and vulnerabilities and their prejudices. And that's basically what he is, Edward. He is an invention of his own prejudices, his own vulnerability.
That was Timothy Spall speaking to Ashanti Omkar. Earlier we heard from Anjana Vasan and Thea Sharrock. Wicked Little Letters is out now in the UK. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, John Everard and Daniela Pelled. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Neoma Ekwe. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.